We've been looking at the mental attitude of David, and we found in the 34th Psalm, in the cave at Adullam, his whole mental attitude gets turned around. And with his confidence now renewed, instead of running from the Philistines, he is now ready to take them on in battle. And if you keep your finger in Psalm 27, let me see if I can bring you up to date on where we are by looking at 1 Samuel 23. Keep the Psalm open, but 1 Samuel chapter 23. In our last session in chapter 21 and part of chapter 22, David is filled with fear. He runs from the Philistines, gets his mind renewed in the cave of Adullam, Psalm 34, and now he is once again ready to fight the Philistines. And notice the way that reads in chapter 23. Then they told David, saying, "Behold, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and are plundering the threshing floors." So David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go and attack these Philistines?" Notice he is ready now to fight, not to flee. And the Lord said to David, "Go and attack the Philistines and deliver Keilah." David's men said to him, "Behold, we are afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the ranks of the Philistines?" Then David inquired of the Lord once more. And the Lord answered him and said, "Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines to your hand." In other words, David, do you believe that the battle is the Lord's? Are you back on that operating principle again? So, verse 5 says, he was. So David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines. He led away their livestock, struck them with great slaughter. Then David delivered the inhabitants of Keilah. So he is back on track now, and we need to look at a psalm that is probably be one of David's strongest confidence psalms, and that is Psalm number 27. Psalm 27. Now, when you look at Psalm 27, it easily divides into two parts based on David's mood. Chapter 27, verses 1 through 6 is the first part, and then 7 through the end, verse 14, is the second part. And what we have is this. The prominent idea in the first six verses is David's faith. Chapter 27, 1 through 6. And in discussing his faith, he first of all talks about his confidence. And then he second talks about the concept of communion or fellowship with God. Confidence and communion are the two themes that come in to these verses. 27, 1 through 3, confidence. And communion, 27, 4 through 6. Now let's just use the first verse for the idea of tremendous confidence. "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear?" In other words, it's a rhetorical question saying, since I'm putting my confidence in the Lord, where are my enemies? Second statement, "The Lord is the defense of my life. Whom shall I dread?" And a thrust all the way through on the enormous confidence that he has, and that is part of his faith. But not only is that part of the picture, but his faith also focuses on the concept of fellowship. Verse 4, "One thing have I asked from the Lord, that shall I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life," etc., etc. And the emphasis is on his communion and fellowship. However, the moment you come to verse 7, you take this tremendous section of confidence and you now move to David's concerns. I almost call them David's fears. And that's 27, 7 through 14. Verse 7 begins, "Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice, and be gracious to me and answer me. When you say, 'Seek my face,' my heart said to thee, 'Thy face, O Lord, I shall seek.' Do not hide from me. Do not turn thy servant away in anger. Thou hast been my help. Don't abandon me." And so notice the concern that he will be abandoned. Verse 12, "Do not deliver me over to the desire of my adversaries." Now, the contrast in thought between, "I am so confident in the Lord, you can't name anybody that can defeat me." And then he comes along with verse 7 and says, "Lord, don't abandon me." In fact, these two sections contrast one another so much that you can pick up many writers on the book of Psalms, and the way they handle these two contrasting sections, how can David be so full of faith and in the same verse be so full of concerns? How can he be so confident that God is with me and then turn around and say, "Oh Lord, don't abandon me"? How can that be in one psalm? The answer of many writers is this: it can't be. These are two different authors. This is not even the same man writing in verse 7 through 14 that wrote in 1 through 6. And they simply take the psalm, they pull it apart, and they say somebody else picked up the pen with verse 7 and is not the same author as the one in verses 1 through 6 because of the contrasting attitude. How can he have a tone of confidence and that be mixed in the same man with a tone of fear? I don't know about you, but I don't have any trouble identifying with that at all. Do you? Do you ever find mixed in your own mentality a confidence that the Lord will take care of it, and yet you're shaking in your boots at the same time? Does that mean you're two different people? Not at all. And we'll find out that these things are, and this is one of the practical aspects of David, is he can come on and say in all sincerity, "Oh God, you're always with me. You won't forsake me, will you?" It's wasn't this episode, but I think the first time Greg decided he was going to move out and live in his own apartment, bold, move all the furniture, get all ready to go. Parting words: "You guys won't change my bedroom, will you?" Which is saying, "I'm leaving, but I want a parachute." And you can have very mixed feelings and be very independent. "I'm resting in the Lord." And yet at the same time, every Christian life is filled with mountains and valleys. You can't get around it. And this psalm here is going to reflect it for us. Under his concern, he is going to turn to two things. He's going to rest on the compassion of God, and that will be in verses 7 through 12, and then the comfort of God, and that will be in 13 and 14. Let's get those key thoughts. First, how in his concern, he is concerned that he will be treated compassionately with God. Verse 10, "For my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me up." And the theme, therefore, is the compassion of God. Verses 13 and 14, and in particular verse 13, "I would have despaired unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living." And therefore, this will be the outline we'll look at tonight. And we begin with David's faith. In 1 through 6. And the first focal point in his faith is his confidence. And his confidence is made very clear by means of a past or a present, past, and future construction. Let's write that down. First, his present confidence in the present time, in the present moment, is verse 1. His confidence with reference to the past is verse 2. His confidence with reference to the future is verse 3. And let's read them through and see if you don't see very easily that's the way it's put together. So you begin with verse 1. The Lord is my light and my salvation. He's talking about now. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the defense of my life. Whom shall I dread? The present tense is the idea. But notice in verse 2, he shifts to a past tense and says, when evildoers came upon me to devour my flesh, my adversaries and my enemies, they stumbled and they fell. And he's looking to the past. But what about verse 3? Verse 3 anticipates the future and says, though a host encamp against me, my heart will not fear. Notice the future tense. Though war rise against me, in spite of this, I shall be confident. So he's simply saying, I want to express in these three verses the confidence that I have in God now, in the past, and in the future. So let's go, first of all, to the present and make a few notes about that. First of all, in verse 1, you have a nominal sentence, and that means you need to cross out the little copula is. It's a Hebrew sentence without a verb. Hebrew sentences without verbs emphasizes an axiom, a general truth. So literally, Yahweh, my light and my salvation, whom shall I fear? Yahweh, the defense of my life, whom shall I dread? And this is axiomatic to David. Now, there's one other interesting thing. This is the only place in the Old Testament where Yahweh is given the name light. There are places that talks about how God gives light, sheds light, leads in the light, but here Yahweh is light. So our first note will be this. This is the only place God's name is called light. It's the only place God's name is called light. In other words, it's the only place where you could legitimately look up to him and say, light, and light would be his name. And again, notice your Lord all in caps. It's the only true God. Yahweh, the only true God, is light. You think of one other place where another person claims the name light. How about the Gospel of John, chapter 12, verse 46, where he says, I am the light of the world. So this is the claim of this psalm. It is also the claim of Jesus in John 12, 46. And what is that saying? I claim the same name, light, that Yahweh claims. And by the way, that's another one of the little incidental proofs that you come along of the falsity of the Jehovah Witness, who would claim that Jesus is less than Yahweh. Well, how about this here? Only Yahweh is named light. And when Jesus comes along and says, that's my name too, what's that equivalent to doing? That's equivalent to saying, I also am Yahweh. I am deity, and if he can be called light, only one calls such in the Old Testament, then I in the New Testament can be called light. So it's really, on his part, a claim to deity.
Now, another thing that God is also salvation. Whenever you see the word salvation in Old or New Testament, always remember this. The basic idea is delivery. Basic idea of the Hebrew and Greek word for salvation is delivery, and it may be, and you have to decide each time which it is, physical or spiritual. Now, you say, well, which is it here in Psalm 27:1? I would lean toward primarily physical, wouldn't you? The Lord is my delivery, physical. Why? Well, because he talks about verse 2, the evildoers that came upon him to devour his flesh. And probably, therefore, he is talking about the physical delivery that he has given, not to exclude the other by any means. Second, the Lord is my defense. And that is more often than anything else in the Old Testament used of a fortress. It's used of a fortress. Physical fortress. So the idea would be in salvation that the Lord delivers him, and in being a defense is where the Lord protects him from trouble. Now, what is the logic of chapter 27, verse 1? The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Now, this is pure New Testament doctrine. Where else is there a reasoning that, well, God is on my side? Where are my enemies? Someone turn me to it? Where is that logic found? This is very Pauline. The logic is God is, and I'll give more of the words that you'd find in the New Testament statement. The Lord is on my side. Where are my enemies? We're going to what? We're going to Romans 8. Let's take a look at verse 31. This is New Testament doctrine in the Old and Old Testament doctrine in the New. Chapter 8, verse 31. And as you know, this is very much core doctrine in the New Testament. So verse 31, what shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who is against us? And the idea there is not that we don't have any enemies. The idea is if God is for us, who is an effective enemy? Now, isn't that exactly the logic of Psalm 27:1? Yahweh is my light and my salvation. If he's for me, whom shall I fear? The Lord is the defense of my life. Whom shall I dread? So in verse 1 then, we've got New Testament doctrine in the Old and Old Testament doctrine brought forward to the New and shows the harmony of certain basic things in Old and New Testament. We've said many, many times there's nothing more important than distinguish Israel from the church. Israel, for example, had an earthly destiny, which was the land of Palestine. What's our earthly destiny? We don't have one. We may stand up and say all we want to and sing all we want to, I am bound for the promised land. And I always want to say, oh no, we're not bound for the promised land. Because that is the destiny of Israel, it's not the destiny of the church. However, even though Israel and the church are absolutely distinct, does that mean they're not similarities? And if we say they're not, what about this one right here? God was for Israel. What enemies could they possibly have that would be effective? God is for us. What possible enemies would we have? So it's a truth that runs throughout all of Scripture. All right. Moving now to the past. The past. Oh, we should in his life get the thrust of verse 1 is so contradictory to what David had been doing. For example, I mean, he tried some of the most bizarre means of delivery. I think we had one of the most bizarre ones in Psalm 34, didn't we? He needed delivery from the king of Gath, so he scribbled on the doors and let the spit run down his beard and convinced the king that he was crazy. It's quite a scheme. In another occasion, he went up to a place called Nob, and he tells the priest up there, so he'll get protection, I'm on a secret mission for the king. No, he wasn't. Another place, he relays the message to Saul that he was going to Bethlehem, and he goes and hides in a field. And it's very interesting to see this man with all of these almost laughable schemes, one after another. How do you harmonize this with the guy in verse 1? Well, again, I can find it easy to identify. Don't you find yourself many, many times totally inconsistent and concocting little schemes that are totally inconsistent with the care of God? Or am I only talking to myself? We're all schemers, are we not? And hey, David's right in there. He says, I've done the same thing. I trust him and I know I don't have an enemy on God's earth. Would you please hide me in this bale of hay over here so Saul won't kill me? And that's David. He's a very, I think that's why people love David, is that you can identify with the man. The nation, there is no king over Israel ever that even approached the love the people had for David. And I think it must have been because David was such a for real person. When he sinned, he sinned. When he trusted the Lord, he trusted the Lord. When he schemed, he schemed. And when he schemed, he would come out and say, I schemed, I was wrong, I wasn't trusting the Lord. He was upfront about it in every case. In fact, God gave him a special little something to do in Psalm 51. Tell the whole world about your adultery and murder of Uriah. And he did so. But that's David. David is a very upfront person, and that's why I think most of us really find it easy to identify with David. Now, let's move from verse 1, the present, now to the past, verse 2. Now notice verse 2, how does it relate to verse 1? Verse 2 relates past experience. Past experience supports the confidence of verse 1. In other words, how can I be as confident as I was in verse 1? Because of the fact of verse 2. I can look over my shoulder and I can support my present confidence by the past victories. When evildoers came on me to devour my flesh, notice he pictures his enemies as wild animals, to devour my flesh, my adversaries, my enemies, they stumbled and fell. So I take courage from the past. Now, look into the future. Though a host encamp about me, notice the idea here, David's confidence does not change the enemy. God did not soften the heart of Saul. God did not take away the enemies. God did not take away those people that were trying to kill him. What did God do? We're back to the same old thing. Gave him a mental attitude delivery. Is Saul sitting right around that corner to kill you? Two options. Be afraid, or option... You two on the back row have talked and talked and talked. Not only tonight, but repeatedly. I want it stopped. Don't you dare speak again this hour. You're disrupting people. Someone had to move up in order to hear the lesson. And you interrupt the Holy Spirit, you're discourteous to me and discourteous to the Word of God. And I will not tolerate it, period. Okay, coming down to the third verse then, you have the future. Though a host encamp against me, my heart will not fear. Though war arise, and again, these are all anticipated things, that there is a host there that will encamp against him. There is the possibility of war, and as we will see, he will go to it over and over again. In spite of this, I will be confident. Can you see the wrap-up of the theme of confidence
That's where he is now. That's what had happened in the past. And that is what is going to happen in the future. Now, David also is like us at another point. Have you not, like I have, said, Lord, from this day forward, I will trust you forever and ever and ever. And then turn around and said what he says no farther down than a few breaths. Oh, Lord, don't abandon me. Don't leave me. And therefore, that's very real. God did not strike him. As a matter of fact, why do you think God gave this to us for all time? Because it's as true tonight as it has been ever. His confidence. Now, notice with verse 4, the idea shifts from confidence to the idea of communion. And that statement is so very strong because the first and emphatic word, and it's translated well in our version, one thing. And it's like saying, one thing only, or one thing alone, I have asked from the Lord that I shall seek. And then notice that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Behold the beauty of the Lord. Doesn't this all spell out communion and fellowship? And to meditate in his temple. Now, the idea here of communion revolves about three infinitives. Two of them you can catch, one you would miss. The first is in verse 4. One thing have I asked from the Lord, that shall I seek, that I may, and Hebrew says, to dwell. I want to dwell. This is all going to fall under the caption of communion, and this is the first thing he wants to do, is to dwell. Then the next one is clear, to behold. And then the final one is to meditate. So, verse 4, here's what I want. I want to dwell, to meditate, and to behold and to meditate. Each one, first of all, to dwell. Now, if we were in the Old Testament times, any godly Israelite, and this is a little hard for us to grasp because we don't so much associate fellowship with God with a building as we do with something very personal. In the Old Testament, for a godly Israelite, there was nothing that you desired any more than to live where God lived. And where did God live? God lived in the temple. God lived in the temple. And that's where I want to live. I'll just put God lived in the temple, desire, me too. If that's where he lives, that's where I want to live. And that's the thrust of the idea of fellowship with the Lord. So again, dwelling in the temple, idea involved with it is fellowship. We have captioned communion using the words interchangeably. Second, besides I want to dwell, I want to behold. I'm going to put to see. That's really what the word means. I want to dwell. I want to behold. Now, this word is used in two ways. It's used of seeing God after death. Seeing God after death. It's also used of seeing God in life. Now let's take, and we're taking the word behold, it's found in the last part of verse 4, to behold the beauty of the Lord, and take it to Job 19. Job 19. And we're looking at the same word for behold, and notice it's a reference to after this life, verse 26 and 27.
even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh, or literally apart from my flesh, that is not in my flesh, that is in my body, I shall see, same word as what he wants to do now, I shall see God, and whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes shall see, and not another, my heart faints within me. So, David is saying what then in Psalm 27? I want to see God now like I see him in eternity. In other words, I want the same closeness. We're told to be absent from the body is to be present from the Lord. Put that in New Testament terms, I want to be as close to God now as I will be when I die. And that is part of David's very noble cry coming in this this section. Okay, third, going back to 27, I want to meditate. I want to meditate. Last part of verse 4. And to meditate in his temple. Now, there's an interesting thing. The word to meditate is what we've explained before is a hifil stem, means cause it. I want to be caused to meditate, and the word meditate carries with it the idea of consider, think about, reflect, even investigate. I want to investigate what I see, reflect on what I see, consider what I see in the temple of the Lord. And do not these three words, dwell, meditate or see, and meditate, all come under the idea of David's communion. Now, in verse 5, he's going to say, in 6, he's going to say two separate things. The logical flow is this. If I trust him, if I have fellowship with him, what will come out of it? So let's just simply caption here. What is the outcome of fellowship? What is the outcome of this fellowship? Or let's put it this way. What is the outcome of faith, verses 1 through 3, and the outcome of fellowship, verse 4. What will come out of these things? If I maintain faith in him, and if I get the one single thing that I ask for, what is the outcome going to be? And we'll put the outcome in two categories. Number one, if I maintain fellowship and faith in him, let me tell you what he will do for me. And then let me tell you what I will do for him. But first, what he will do with me. Verse 5, what I will do for him. Verse 6, first, what he will do from him, for me. And notice the three verbs. For in the day of trouble, he will conceal me in his tabernacle. In the secret place of his tent, he will hide me. And then third, he will lift me. So notice the three things. First, here's what he will do if we trust him. He will conceal. If we have faith, and the link is very important between the faith in the first three verses, the fellowship in verse 4. Now, what is going to be the outcome of all? Number one, he will conceal me. The basic meaning of that word is simply to hide. Keep your finger here and look at Exodus 2, verse 2. Exodus 2, 2. It's very simple. Remember what Moses' mother did with him? She hid him. And so, reading verse 1 to get the context, a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bore a son, And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. Now, if you can think of the care that the mother must have exercising and wrapping the baby, placing the baby in the little crib, and all of the care that a mother would give a newborn. Same word David uses, for that's what God does to me. If I trust him, if I keep fellowship with him, he will put me in a protective place, just like the mother of Moses put Moses in a protective place. Look also at Proverbs 10 for another sort of word picture. Proverbs 10, verse 14. There's a little more than just keep. There's an idea of, you'll see it in verse 14. Wise men store knowledge. That gives a little more strength to the word, doesn't it? It's the idea of hiding and to treasure as a treasure. To treasure, like wise men treasure wisdom. So the Lord will treasure and will hide, again in the case of Moses, as for protection. Second, not only he will conceal, but our translation says he will hide. And basically the word is very similar to the above one. The difference is it is causative. He will cause me to be hidden. And I take it the idea would be God will care for me with or without means. He will either hide me himself or see that I am hidden, cause me to be hidden. God will care for me with or without means. In other words, he may care for me by using the means of someone else. I think there of Jonathan. Jonathan many times was instrumental in protecting the life of David. And so you can say, the Lord will hide me through a Jonathan. Or without any means at all. Remember in the creation account, God creates some things without means, some other things with means. And God can save either way. And this is what David is saying. He'll conceal me, he'll treasure me, he will hide me with or without means. And then third, he will lift. The Hebrew word room means to make high, lift up high. And the idea would be if you can see him surrounded with all kinds of problems and difficulties, God lifts him up so that he's out of all these things. Sort of like saying, God will keep my head above water. Or lift me up. Yes, Bill. They are all three words that were used for both the tabernacle and for the temple. Both words used for the temple. Yeah. The tent is more connected, however, to the tabernacle than it would be the temple, because the temple was bricks and stones and what have you. But I think we mentioned during the tools conference, did we not, that in the Hebrew language, there's no word for home. Simply bath, it means shelter. That's the best you can get in the Old Testament, best you can get out of Hebrew, a shelter. And the idea was, with the storm and all the things that are going around you, God provides a shelter for you in the midst of it. No, those are synonymous. And you can tell that would be typical of Hebrew poetry, wouldn't it? Repetition. Line after line after line to get a single truth across. Okay, and keep in mind, all these things now are tied to fellowship. Now, If he will conceal, he will hide, and he will lift, then doesn't it follow then that there ought to be an appropriate response on David's part? So, what I will do for him. What I will do for him. And that's found in verse 6. You see the three verbs? And now my head will be lifted up above mine enemies around me. Notice once again, God didn't take away enemies. There is no hint of any pressure removed by dealing with the enemy. The enemy was still there. But his head was above the enemy. Notice the victory is in mental attitude. The victory is in the way we think. And that's a stress all the way through, and we'll be re-emphasizing it. Saul never changed. God never changed Saul. God changed David. And when it was a matter of a man opposing David, God did not remove the opposer. God shored up David. And isn't that the most common delivery God can deliver us? By removing the problem, or God can deliver us by giving us the mental attitude to handle the problem. And I'll let you do your own guessing, which more often is he likely to do? Take it away or take us through? Classic example, of course, is Paul, is it not? Three times he said about his thorn in the flesh, take it away, take it away, take it away. And God did what? My grace is sufficient for you. I will not take it away. But I can help you get your head together. And that is always, always critical. Because it puts the responsibility at our doorstep and in no sense. And again, as we come through this, Saul is the same in verse 1 as he was at the end of the chapter. He's always, always the same. He never gives up on wanting to kill David, but David gets the victory because he had it together mentally in faith in the Lord and in fellowship with the Lord. And that is critical. Now, in verse 6, what is David going to say he will do for the Lord? Now my head will be lifted up above my enemies around me. They're still surrounding him. I will offer in his tents sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing. Yes, I will sing. So, just as God did three things for David, David says, I will do three things for God. And they are, I will offer. And the reference to an offering for the Lord involved two things. It was ritual and it was public. Because sacrifices were done at the temple in public view. And it was a ritual in a good sense of the word. I think we usually take ritual as being bad. Ritual can be very, very good. When we take the Lord's table, isn't that a ritual? It's something that we do physically, that we go through, and it is ritual. Ritual can deteriorate into terrible things. But even in the book of Isaiah, when God says, I'm sick of your sacrifices, what's he saying? I'm tired of your ritual. Well, who set up the ritual? God did. But when there's no heart with it, that's when it becomes bad. And so the ritual was God-given. He did it publicly, and he did this to the Lord. Second, he says, I will sing. And then in at least the NASB, it looks like he says, I will sing a second time. How does NIV do? Does it give you, I will sing, I will sing? Sing and make music. Okay, that is correct because I will sing implies the same word, clearly. And it is not the same word. And the first one, I will sing, is usually vocal. Make music, I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong place. I will sing, the first one, is usually vocal. I will make music
is usually instrumental. And that's basically the... I'll sing my heart out and I'll blow my lungs out, would be the idea. Or I will sing or I will play the trumpet, God's instrument. One of the two. As over against a French horn. The vocal, this was also usually personal. And make music was usually instrumental or usually public. And so notice the full rounded. God does these three things for me, and I respond to Him by doing these three things. Now, notice with verse 7, whole mood shifts to David's fears or David's concerns. 7 through 14. And he's concerned, and it's amazing that, no, it's not, because we do the same thing, but isn't it amazing in the same breath that all of these wonderful things have been said, David says, I am concerned that God might ignore me, and I am concerned that God might abandon me. Now, does that mean that David is actually saying that I believe that God will forget all about me? Well, I think this is saying, or David's saying, that there's a battle that we all fight. And this is called the battle of perception versus reality. The battle of perception versus reality. Have you ever seen something that you perceived to really need? Couldn't live without it. Asked God for it, didn't get it, and 5 years later, thank God that He didn't respond to your perception of your need. Am I alone on that? Do you remember, if you're a Christian, the first girl that you couldn't live without? And I remember vividly telling God I could not live without her. Today I say, oh, thank God that He knew what was a perception and responded with reality. And this again is what David is saying. I don't think there's a lack of faith coming down to verse 7. It's simply a recognition that I need the Lord. It's like this. Do you ever learn to appreciate someone by saying, what would I do without them? And you try to go down all the things that would be missing if they weren't there. If I didn't have Betty, I would have dirty underwear on. And when do you begin to realize those things? You begin that when they go on a vacation. So I can always call and say, you've been visiting your father long enough. The Dillard's bill on underwear is really skyrocketing. Okay, so he's emphasizing his dependence. Now, notice what he lists in closing. A, B, C, D, no. Now, verse 7. Hear, O Lord, when I cry with my voice. And here's what he's saying. We need His grace. Be gracious to me and answer me. We need His grace. Verse 8, we need His approval. Verse 8, when thou didst say, seek my face, my heart said to thee, thy face, O Lord, I shall seek. Do not hide thy face from me. Do not turn thy servant away in anger. Thou hast been my help. Do not abandon me, O God of my salvation.
For my father and mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me up. We need His grace, verse 7. We need His approval, 8 through 10. We need, verse 11, teach me thy way, O Lord, and lead me in thy path. We need His guidance, His grace, His approval, His guidance, verse 12. Do not deliver me over the desire of my adversaries. We need His protection, and verses 13 and 14. I would have despaired lest I have believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. We need His goodness. Got the, what, five things? We need His grace, 7. We need His approval, 8 through 10. We need His guidance, verse 11. We need His protection, verse 12. And we need His goodness, verses 13 and 14. So, to end, we need and do a constant battle of mountains and valleys. We do a constant battle with appearances and reality. And I think the psalm teaches one other neat thing also. When you're in a valley, you don't have to hide it. He was in a valley and He said so. He was on a mountain and He said so. And apparently God appreciated that so much that He said, David, let's record your mountaintop and let's record your valley that you were so open with me about. Let's record it for all times. Because in November of 1994 in Kansas City, there'll be some people that have valleys and that have mountains, and we can as freely open them up to the Lord as David did. I think we're all acquainted with the plain old psychological principle of catharsis. How good it is sometimes just to get it out. You talk to a friend, they didn't have an answer, but they had an ear. Well, God says, I want to be your ear. Let me hear about it. Let me talk. You think I've abandoned you? Tell me. Do you think I've forgotten me? Remind me not to forget you. That's the kind of God He is. He's personal. He's not awesome. He doesn't... what's the verse in James about those who ask? He doesn't... what's the word? He doesn't upbraid. Doesn't censure those that ask of Him. And this is a very healthy thing mentally, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, to be able to do what David did in relationship to the Lord. Father, we're thankful for Your word and Your truth. May we understand it in order to obey it. In Christ's name. Amen.